Pope Benedict XVI on Friday ended his 8-day pilgrimage to the Holy Land, saying that this journey has left him with powerful impressions of hope and of sadness.
I had fruitful discussions with the civil authorities, both in Israel and in the Palestinian territories, and I witnessed the great efforts that both governments are making to secure people's well-being. I have met the leaders of the Catholic Church in the Holy Land, and I rejoice to see the way that they work together in caring for the Lord's flock. I have also had the opportunity to meet the leaders of the various Christian churches and ecclesial communities, as well as the leaders of other religions in the Holy Land.
This, the Pope continued, is indeed a fertile ground for ecumenism and interreligious dialogue. And I pray, he said, that the rich variety of religious witness in the region will bear fruit in a growing mutual understanding and respect. During his intense visit that took him first to Jordan and then to Israel and to the Palestinian territories, Benedict also appealed for peace between Israelis and Palestinians so each can live in their own state as trustful neighbours in security. But many were the impressions conveyed during this time. Watching from afar, I personally collected an array of favourite or moving moments and decided to ask someone else to tell me of theirs. Benedictine abbot Timothy Wright, who has been following the journey for personal and professional reasons, agreed to give me a few early reflections upon Pope Benedict's return.
I think the first thing that has to be said is the remarkable courage and strength with which the Pope managed to complete a very strenuous 10 days of travel in a very, very complicated part of the world. So one gives thanks that it all went through smoothly. That it wasn't completely smooth is inevitable for anyone who knows what happens in those countries in the Middle East. So these reflections will be the first stage of reflections, because I'm sure there will be reverberations from what he said and what he didn't say for many weeks to come. If I start with the visit to Amman, Jordan, which was always going to be a much easier moment, partly because there is a natural friendship, partly there's a good relationship between the church and Jordan, the people in Jordan, although the church is only a small number in that country. And of course, in the world of dialogue with Islam, His Royal Highness Prince Ghazi has been a very, very important person from the Muslim side leading that dialogue. So that was going to be the theme, the main theme, developing friendship, encouraging the Christian community, but also trying to deepen and energize that dialogue with Islam. And it is interesting that in his phraseology on arrival, the Holy Father made two comments which are of interest. One is that he talked about the common burden of history that Christians and Muslims have.
Muslims and Christians, precisely because of the burden of our common history, so often marked by misunderstanding, must today strive to be known and recognized as worshippers of God, faithful to prayer, eager to uphold and live by the Almighty decrees, and ever mindful of the common origin and dignity of all human persons.
And of course that code refers to a history long distant past, several hundred years ago, of antipathy with the Crusades. It also refers to the more recent history of colonial history, when the European powers had protectorate status in parts of the Middle East. It also refers to the modern history, where for many Muslims the recent invasions of Iraq and all that went with that was seen by many Muslims as a Christian, in inverted commas, invasion. Not exactly how the Western powers would see it, but then part of the dialogue is to try and appreciate how other people see actions which one thinks of as purely secular and political, on the one hand from a European perspective, but from their perspective it'll have a religious perspective. And in that context, the Holy Father went on and talked about the manipulation of religion for political ends.
Is it not also the case that often it is the ideological manipulation of religion, sometimes for political ends, that is the real catalyst for tension and division, at the times even violence in society.
And again, too, that is a phrase leading into the disastrous misinterpretation of what religion is about in order to gain political support and political dominance. And we all know of extremism in religion and the negative effects that that has. And that affects all the major religions, not just Islam, not just Christianity, but also Judaism and indeed Hinduism, Buddhism, etc. They all have a larger or smaller group of politically minded religious enthusiasts. And that is something that all religions have to face if there is to be a genuine dialogue and a genuine mutual understanding between what is essential to religion, which of course is the worship of God, which is the recognition that our lives are in the hands of the divine being, and that God, for Muslims and Christians particularly, is a God of mercy and forgiveness. It was interesting that in Prince Ghazi's welcome to the Pope, he made reference to a very important element which all Christians and Muslims have to face, which is that our literature and our education about the other is often very distorted. And he referred particularly to distorted views of the Prophet, the Holy Prophet, in the West.
These distorted depictions by those who either do not know Arabic or the Holy Quran and the Hadith, or who do not understand the historical and cultural context of the Prophet's life, and thus misunderstand and misconstrue the spiritual motives and intentions behind many of the Prophet's, sallallahu alaihi wasallam's, actions and words, are unfortunately responsible for much historical and cultural tension between Christians and Muslims.
But he went on to say that we can and we must, as worshippers of the one God who created us and is concerned for each person in every corner of the world. And it is that recognition of God's creative power at the heart of every believer, which is shared so deeply by Muslims and Christians, which has to be the starting point for the dialogue and the mutual cooperation in practical ways, which does exist in many parts of the world and needs to be affirmed, but it could be more of it. And of course, the Holy Father, on his way to Jordan, put into a neat nutshell what he was trying to do. His complete conviction that God listens, God responds to prayer, God is available to inspire us. And out of that comes the energizing, the sensitizing of our conscience, and the conscience which enables us to choose right and avoid wrong and to make a diagnosis of what is good and what is bad. And alongside that, a big theme of what he said on many occasions is that we have to use our minds, we have to think about these things. Our reason is there so that we can be logical, understanding. And that, of course, is something that will be different from different traditions, but nevertheless, it is, if we allow emotion to take over, emotion distorts. And in order to appreciate all that, he went on to say, we have to learn the language of the other.
E dobbiamo fare tutto per imparare uno il linguaggio dell'altro.
And that is something very demanding. And it means not just learning the words, it means getting into the mind and heart of how other people think. Christians learning how Muslims think, Muslims learning how Christians think, all of us learning how Jewish people think, etc., etc. And then finally he said, I come with hope, because we have to build optimism into people's lives. We have to try to break down the walls of division, suspicion, hatred, in order to build trust, and from that trust to bring life. So in that sort of way, the Pope's visit to Jordan and the Pope's starting point was on a very constructive basis, with a very positive message, but with a very, very demanding journey, and one which, thank God, he has successfully completed.
I'm going to ask you a personal question then. Would you like to pick out what you think were some of the most beautiful moments, maybe the most emotionally charged moments, the ones that maybe were your favourites?
Yes, indeed. There were a number of moments. I thought the moment at Yad Vashem, which got much criticised in the press, particularly in some of the Israeli press, I thought that, in a sense, it wasn't read closely enough. They were worried that he didn't come back. He's talked about killed rather than murdered, that he didn't mention the 6 million people who died, etc. But what did he say? He talked about standing in silence in the memory of the millions who lost lives but never lost out of the memory. They didn't lose their name.
They lost their lives, but they will never lose their names. They are indelibly etched in the hearts of their loved ones, the surviving fellow prisoners, and all souls determined never to allow such an atrocity to disgrace mankind again.
And by focusing on the idea that someone's identity is in their name and the name is recorded for history to remember, is a very powerful image of what Yad Vashem stands for. Indeed, it's what every graveyard stands for. But in the context of Yad Vashem, it's a way of saying that they may have been Jewish people, that may have been the victims of the most horrible, horrible crime, which is indeed true, but their memory is not just simply for the Jewish people. Their memory in Yad Vashem is for the whole human world to take on board what happened, why it happened, and to prevent it ever happening again to any people. He very specifically condemned anti-Semitism and said it has no right to stand in any society as any way of solving any problem. It's totally unacceptable, he said, and must never, ever be allowed to gain ground.
May the names of these victims never perish. May their suffering never be denied, belittled, or forgotten. And may all people of goodwill remain vigilant in rooting out from the heart of men anything that could lead to tragedies such as this.
And that is something that needs to be said again, as we see in various ways, there are people who are still anti-Semitic, and they need to face the problem. Why are they anti-Semitic? And he is deliberately saying that is something we have to face on. You can't just say, oh, well, each person's allowed his, her own opinion. There are some opinions which are destructive of being human and should therefore not be allowed. And that comes through in his Yad Vashem speech and his speech on arrival, where he does mention the 6 million.
It is right and fitting that during my stay in Israel, I will have the opportunity to honour the memory of the 6 million Jewish victims of the Shoah and to pray that humanity will never again witness a crime of such magnitude.
And at the very end of that little tribute, that little comment, that little meditation in Yad Vashem, he just says, we wait in silence to remember, to pray, and to hope.
My dear friends, I am deeply grateful to God and to you for the opportunity to stand here in silence, a silence to remember, a silence to pray, a silence to hope.
To remember, yes, the names. These are people in the mind of God. To pray that God strengthens us, makes us realize the unique significance of every human life, wherever he, she is born, conceived. And to hope that this message will get to people everywhere, that they are valued, and that particularly those who have the possibility of changing the economic, the social, the situation, religious situation of people, will do so in order to allow that proper freedom for people to express their religion, whatever it may be. So in that sense, that would be one of my first highlights of the trip. I think in other ways, his prayer at the Wailing Wall, again, was a very moving moment, that holy place for all the Jewish people in Jerusalem on the edge of the old temple. But my third area, which I think is of very particular significance, is that his visit to Bethlehem. I've had the honour of and pleasure of visiting Bethlehem 3 or 4 years ago when I had to go through this security barrier or the wall. And the sense of the difference of going from one side to the other has haunted me ever since. And so it was good to read in one of the accounts of the journalists who were coming how horrid for them it was to get through this. It took them 90 minutes, fully equipped with every possible pass from every possible authority as part of the papal entourage, but 90 minutes to go through the wall. Now, if these people, just think for a moment what it's like for a Palestinian trying to go the other way. And I'm sorry to say, it's in my own scene, people, seen the guards and the border control people just throw Palestinian identity cards, just throw it on the floor. There is a terrible physical barrier, but in that physical barrier there is a human insult and there's human degradation. Of that there is no doubt. And for the Pope to go through into the Palestinian territories, into Bethlehem, he sensed, clearly sensed, the power of that wall. And power of that wall as not just physical separation, but human degradation. The sense of being trapped, of the sense of being confined. And when he visited the refugee camp, the Palestinian refugee camp in Bethlehem, standing with his back to the wall, he was deeply moved by it. And throughout, he maintained, in his own terms, the right of the Palestinian people to have a homeland within internationally recognized borders.
Mr. President, the Holy See supports the right of your people to a sovereign Palestinian homeland and the land of your forefathers, secure and at peace with its neighbors, within internationally recognized borders.
Why did he have to use that rather clumsy statement? The world has come to know of the two-state solution, but the new government in Israel will not accept that phraseology. So he was coming into a political minefield, so he didn't use that provocative term as far as the new government is concerned, and stuck with, or created his own thing, a homeland within internationally recognized borders. Homeland, this is our home, we live here, we are in control, we control our economy, we work for our ends, we are not the dependent on anyone else, we're not part of, in inverted commas, an apartheid state, we're not part of a prison camp, in inverted commas. We are an internationally recognized country with all that that implies in terms of trade relations, in terms of economic development, in terms of freedom for social development, in terms of freedom for religion, in terms of freedom to move in and out, in terms of being recognized by all our surrounding peoples as what we are. And so it was a powerful statement of the Holy See's commitment to that right, basic right, of the Palestinian people. And of course, historically speaking, the arrival of Israel as a country in the 1948, when it was recognized by the United Nations, set up the immediate problem, what do we do with non-Jewish Israelis? And of course, we know that 20% of even Israel today is not Israeli Jews. They're not Jewish, they're Israelis, but they're Arab Muslims. And among the opinions that are expressed within Israel, there is the view that these people should be deprived of basic rights, like rights to vote, like rights to have same education as a Jewish Israeli. It is a form of, if you like, soft apartheid. And so there is a real problem in the relationship of the two peoples. And the difficulty that anyone going into that situation and preaching not only freedom of religion, Christians, Jews, Muslims, but also the right of the indigenous people to have their own proper economic development implies that they have their own state. Because the conclusion is the two cannot live together in one state, particularly if the birth rates continue as they are, which is at a higher birth rate among the Palestinians than among the Jewish Israeli immigrants, settlers, so that inevitably the Jewish majority would eventually be lost. So you can see the anxiety and the worry on both sides. And the side with the power at the moment is the one that is being able to control how this wants to develop. And as far as the present government are concerned, that phrase two-state solution is not an answer, because that is giving away what they regard as part of their inherited land, which is the ancient land of Israel, which is theirs as Jewish, given to them through Moses at the time of the entry and the crossing of the Jordan River with Joshua as the whole land, the new territory, the land of the covenant. And you see their historical, biblical basis for what they're claiming. But then you have to ask the question, what do you do with the people who are there already? And coming back to the Pope's statement, a homeland within internationally recognized borders, and there's a long way to go before people can find the proper way forward. And the Pope, by using that phrase, recognized that the present government, being sensitive to their position and wanting to avoid a conflict, but nevertheless making the statement, these are people who need to have their rights suppressed. And in that phraseology and the recognition of this wall, this barrier, and calling it a stalemate, it's a dead barrier. It doesn't have any life to it.
Towering over us, as we gather here this afternoon, is a stark reminder of the stalemate that the relations between Israelis and Palestinians seem to have reached the wall. In a world where more and more borders are being opened up to trade, to travel, to movement of peoples, to cultural exchanges, it is tragic to see walls still being erected. How we long to see the fruits of the much more difficult task of building peace.
And imply that these walls don't go on forever. And those of us who live in Europe will know the Berlin Wall didn't last forever. So that was the way that the Pope gave wonderful encouragement to the aspirations of the people of Bethlehem and indeed of the whole people of the West Bank, whether in Jericho or Ramallah or Jenin or in Hebron. The other moment, I think, which will stay in my mind, was the moment in Nazareth where he met perhaps the largest group of Christians assembled. He celebrated Vespers in the Basilica of the Annunciation. He had a meeting with the leaders, religious leaders of all the religious groups in Nazareth, and ended with that, had a series of wonderful homilies and presentations by various religious leaders, Druze, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, but ending with this prayer.
Salam, shalom.
And it was wonderful to see the Pope get up at the end and join hands with the people around on the stage with him, all praying for peace, for unity, for tolerance among themselves, in their countries, in their state.
Lord, grant us peace. Lord, grant us peace. Lord, grant us peace.
And it was a wonderful moment where that bit of emotion suddenly burst through and everyone was smiling and it had a wonderful end to a meeting which clearly could have been quite difficult, but in fact was very smooth and very affirming for everyone taking part and a good springboard to continue. That then moved into the Vespers and the singing of Vespers in Latin and in Arabic. Again, showing the sensitivity to the Arab people who live in Nazareth, as well as the Christians who come there, both in pilgrimage and the people who live there in the various communities helping out. And it was wonderful to see the Sisters of Charity there, the Missionaries of Charity, who, of course, are the only religious group in Gaza, that embattled little group of Catholics there, doing such wonderful work for the Gazan people in most terribly difficult circumstances. And it was a reminder of the fact that the Pope didn't visit Gaza, and the Pope perhaps felt, and the authorities felt, perhaps quite rightly, it was just too sensitive for him to visit it. But the presence of those Missionaries of Charity at that Vespers reminded us that there is in Gaza a Catholic community, which then reminded us of the tremendous suffering of the Gazan people over the recent violence and the recent war.
So, now that Pope Benedict has ended his pilgrimage, Abbot Timothy Wright told me, he is sure he can feel well satisfied with what has been achieved.
A very grueling pilgrimage has been completed. Well over 25 discourses have been given. He's moved from Amman to Tel Aviv to Jerusalem to Bethlehem to Nazareth, back to Jerusalem. And he's got there for some idea of how small the country is. And yet how everything is uncertain. There is a real sense of emotional trauma, of abuse, of victimhood. Palestinians victims of an imposed solution, as they would put it. It wasn't us who caused the Holocaust, but we are having to be the solution for the Jewish people. And the other side of it, we the Jewish people, the Zionist dream of we want our land back and we're going to make sure we get it. And that, out of those two positions, has emerged 40, 50 years now of violence on and off, both within the Israel-Palestine area itself, but also in the neighbouring countries, particularly with Lebanon, with Syria, less so with Jordan, and of course with Egypt. And so it's an area in which tension, any sort of tension, raises the scepter of more violence, and more violence raises the scepter of innocent death, of destruction of livings, of destruction of homes, of destruction of families, of pain. And pain, for so many people who live there, is not something that's here today and gone tomorrow. It endures for generation to generation, particularly among the Palestinian people. So it is an area for prayer. The Pope came with a message of hope, a message of concern, and by his presence highlighted some of the difficulties.
Mr. President, I thank you for the warmth of your hospitality, which is greatly appreciated, and I wish to put on record that I come to visit this country as a friend of the Israelis, just as I am a friend of the Palestinian people. Friends enjoy spending time in one another's company, and they find it deeply distressing to see one another suffer. No friend of the Israelis and the Palestinians can fail to be threatened by the continuing tension between your two peoples. No friend can fail to weep at the suffering and loss of life that both peoples have endured over the last 6 decades. Allow me to make this appeal to all the people of these lands. No more bloodshed, no more fighting, no more terrorism, no more war.
And so with the Holy Father returning, we congratulate him on what he did. We pray to Almighty God that the seeds he has sown by his discourses will bear rich fruit, and that the peace that everyone in that area wants and the justice which has to go with it will be fully realized in ways that at the moment we can barely dream of or hope for, but with the right enthusiasm, the right energy, the right intentions, something will happen slowly but surely.
Let it be universally recognized that the state of Israel has a right to exist and to enjoy peace and security within internationally agreed borders. Let it be likewise acknowledged that the Palestinian people have a right to a sovereign, independent homeland, to live with dignity and to travel freely. Let the two-state solution become a reality, not remain a dream.
And my heartfelt thanks go to Abbot Timothy Wright for his interesting reflection on Pope Benedict XVI's pilgrimage to the Holy Land.